ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5. And Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395 6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When the Zulu regime initiated the aggression against the Islamic Republic, it had one thing in mind, to destroy Iran's knowledge and expertise. That came in the form of targeted assassinations, war crimes in their own right, in two key sectors, the military and scientific fields. Even though there was some degree of success in this war crime, the U.S.-backed Israeli regime and the U.S. failed in eliminating Iran's scientific and military personnel. Since replacements have taken place in both arenas, while uniting the entire country, as evident in the massive demonstrations and protests of Iranians who bid farewell to the martyrs who gave their lives to the Islamic Republic and to Iran's leader. Joining us in this edition of The Spotlight, we have with us Shebra Rizvi, who is a political analyst who joins us on the phone from London. Shebra Rizvi, welcome. We're taking a look at a massive display of support in the millions all across the Islamic Republic, from ordinary Iranians to people from all spectres of society, including high-ranking officials who bid farewell to the martyrs of this aggression. What message does that send to the Israeli regime, to the U.S., and to all of the allies of both?
Thank you very much. I trust all of you are well and safe. But look, the situation is very clear that what happened, I'm of a certain age that I remember vividly the advent of the Islamic Revolution, which occurred when we had the period of Muharram at that time. And now we are also in the period of Muharram, 46 years later. So the public in Iran are essentially religious, if you like. They are followers of the Ahlul Bayt and the followers of the message of Imam Hussein al-Islam, of not sort of submitting to humiliation at all. And this is what is being clearly shown with these demonstrations. But I think at a wider level, Kaveh, what we have to remember is that Americans and the Israelis have succumbed to such a defeat. They are now promoting two contradictory narratives. One attempts to show off, claiming no side has achieved victory. The other falsely claims that Iran was defeated. But it's all noise. In reality, the sudden collapse of the Israeli and American hegemony and the myth of their military and strategic superiority has been shattered. Reports emerging from Israel clearly expose the fact that telecommunications were jammed, the security system breached, and even their own officials are beginning to admit it. The statements made were not exaggerated. They reflected plain, undeniable truth. Israel and the U.S. are slowly, quietly accepting this reality, even if the despot ruling over them has continued to posture. The truth is unavoidable. The Americans are now entangled in their own contradiction and tightening the noose around themselves. However, the war is not over. It will go on until the Zionist entity is defeated completely, and on the back of that, the Western hegemony in West Asia.
Well, we're going to get into what a complete defeat of the Zionist regime, as you said, would actually be like. But let's go back to this word surrender that the U.S. President Donald Trump used against the Iranian nation. In the words of the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, I'd like to quote him where he said, "Iranians gave blood, not land, gave their loved ones, not honor, that withstood a 1,000-ton rain of bombs, but did not surrender." Tell us your reaction to the statement there by the Iranian foreign minister, and in particular, how he mentioned the fact that Iran did not surrender.
Well, indeed, absolutely. It's very clear that the statement that came out of Trump's mouth in the early hours after the 13th of June a preemptive attack by the Zionist entity was that Iran must surrender. But of course, as you said in your opening comments, there were losses that occurred because of the preemptive nature. And also, as it has become very clear, that 80% of the attacks originated internally because Mossad and its agents through India, working in Jabahar and other places, had located those places. And the recent report just coming out in the last 24 hours shows that over the last 15 years, Mossad and the British and American have been sort of visiting all the sites, and they had data available with them. Plus also, you've got to remember that there are sort of technical IT companies that have also been supporting the Zionist entity. So they had ample information at three levels. One, internal agents working. Secondly, through this IAEA inspection, a lot of data was made available to the Zionist entity. And thirdly, of course, it had all the protection from the monarchies in West Asia who were supporting the Zionist entity. So it's really a remarkable feat when you think about that Iran was able to withstand this particular onslaught, but it did not surrender. And what one's got to really remember is that the whole myth, as I said in my opening comment, of the Zionist entity being supreme and its technology and firepower being unmatchable, that showed very clearly that Iran was able to make dents in it, and the aerial pictures that are now coming out showing that how much damages occurred. And also, Iran did not target civilian bases like the Zionist entity in Tehran and other places. Because the thing that Zionist entity is good as we see what they have done in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, and other places, is to kill civilians, ordinary citizens of a particular nation. But Iran targeted their headquarters, their military headquarters, their security positions, their spy networks, Mossad headquarters. So Iran's technology also proved that they are able to bypass all this bit of supremacy that a Zionist entity was able to enjoy and create this illusion of being a power that no one is able to attack. So really what has happened is the mindset, the fear that has been depicted on the Zionist entity and the occupiers who are living in that part of West Asia, to really realize that the Zionist entity is not able to protect them, and numbers are coming out that hundreds of thousands of Zionists left that day, and the losses that have occurred both in financial and manpower resources from the Zionist entity. And of course, at the economic level, I can go on telling you how much economic losses that the Zionist entity has incurred. And of course, the foreign direct investment is going to be reluctant now to invest in the Zionist entity. So at multiple levels, the Zionist entity has lost. But as I said, the main loss has been that this myth of supremacy of the Zionist entity and its supporters has been really very clear for everyone to see globally. And this, I think, is the game changer that if a future conflict does occur, which is likely to happen, as we all know, that the Zionist entity does not abide by any agreement, does not has no ethics in sort of continuing with ceasefires, as we've seen in Lebanon. There's supposed to be a ceasefire, but they've had over 2,000 attacks. And similarly, they broke multiple ceasefires in Gaza. So I suspect they are perhaps toying for another opportunity to attack the Islamic Republic of Iran. But I'm pretty sure that the next attack of the Zionist entity will be even more disastrous for the Israelis.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, let's take a look at an aspect of this as we're looking at some of the martyrs of the targeted assassinations. We know that the Zulu regime actually initiated the aggression against the Islamic Republic, but the way that it targeted the different sectors, there's two sectors here that were the target of their aggression, and that was the military sector and the scientific sector. In particular, we're looking at military officials and we're looking at nuclear scientists. So they wanted to take that knowledge and expertise out of the equation of the Islamic Republic. They felt like that's where the strength of the Islamic Republic is in their eyes, that should be taken out. But aren't they wrong in that calculation? Because, first of all, in lightning speed, the military officials were replaced, and there are many who advance in the nuclear field of Iran to begin with. And therefore, what they did, which is illegal by international law and war crime in itself, is not going to eliminate what they see as Iran's key abilities in those two sectors.
Indeed. As you quite rightly pointed out, that within 12 hours of the assassination, targeted assassination of the military personnel, Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, was able to replace the individuals very clearly. And as far as the nuclear scientists and you know, sort of knowledge base that is concerned, I've been reading recently that there are over 10,000 nuclear physicists in Iran at this moment. So the intellectual property that Iran has, insofar as development of nuclear science is concerned, that's not going to go away. Even if they assassinate and kill certain individuals, because there is the depth of knowledge that is available, and that knowledge is not going to go away. It may actually ease the knowledge base even further, because now we can see very clearly that even those individuals in the Islamic Republic of Iran who may have been in another camp during the period, this has really ignited, I believe, the fervor of the early days of the revolution, because the generation of that time, you know, people who are under 40, did not live through the Islamic Revolution, so they did not have any experience and motivation. But perhaps, and it's very clear now, that the majority of the people are on board with the government and the leadership in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this will sort of give more impetus to the Islamic Republic of Iran to develop all areas of science and technology, whether it's ballistic missiles or nuclear energy. They will sort of work even further and harder to make the nation stronger for a future attempt by the Zionist entity and supporters.
Do you agree when it comes to Iran's missiles, of which you just mentioned that the other side wants a restriction on it, that Iran would not accept any restrictions on its missile activities, and that this recent aggression demonstrated clearly that without Iran's military capabilities, the Israeli regime would have never been compelled to request a ceasefire?
Oh, absolutely. Why should Iran, especially now, that they have shown that they're able to?
We may have lost Shabir Rizvi there. So basically, the question that I ask here is what actually the UN ambassador, Iran's UN ambassador, has said, and that is the fact that Iran will not accept any restrictions on its missile activities. While we try to get our guests, our other guests also, this is one of the key questions that does arise in terms of, again, putting it into the context of how the U.S. had asked, or should I say had dictated to Iran, that it should surrender. Another key development that comes, which is no surprise, and it's something that it seems like the U.S. President Donald Trump is not, either it's not within his etiquette, nor does he realize that this jeopardizes any premonitions that the U.S. side has at this point in terms of continuing with the, I guess, approach for talks. I do believe that we have Shabir Rizvi back. Are you with us, Shabir Rizvi?
Yes, I think we had some technical issues. I lost you for a few.
Yeah, we did. If you continue where we left off, please.
Yes. What I was saying is that it's very clear that Iran has no intention to curtail its ballistic missiles and other sort of areas of self-defense. Because what the Americans, the British, the collective West has done in the past is to demilitarize countries. And we can see that with Libya and other places where the government in those countries agreed to demilitarize themselves, they were destroyed. Because a bully is not able to fathom a stronger person. Because, the only way a bully can decimate nations is that if they're not able to defend themselves. Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, has very clearly shown that it would defend itself and it would continue to do whatever is necessary to protect its sovereignty, its nationhood, its dignity, its integrity, and its sovereignty. So if those things are in the equation, then there is no reason why the Islamic Republic of Iran should anyway even contemplate negotiating a curtailment of the development of its defense industry. Because as soon as Iran goes that route, then it will sort of it will be the demise of the nation. So at this moment, it's very clear. And the other sort of interesting angle is that I think the Islamic Republic of Iran may actually become an exporter of defense equipment, because it has shown to the world that it has technology which could be in the interest and protection of those nations itself. Because in the past, as we know, the military industrial powers of the West and the Zionist entity have sold their military equipment to the world, saying that how good they are. But now the Islamic Republic of Iran has a product or products that are marketable to the world to stand up to the oppressors. And I think that could be another sort of area of development for the Islamic Republic of Iran, not just to self-defend itself, but also to provide that technology to all the oppressed nations of the world to stand up against the oppressors of the world.
Let me get your reaction, since we're running quickly out of time, about what the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said. And this is this push by both the U.S. and the Israeli regime, Shabir Rizvi, for the Abraham Accords, where headlines are reading, without a window for the ceasefire to transpire, to see that it holds, lo and behold, you having this push and advertisement for normalization. I mean, they're really trying to push this. And even the Israeli Prime Minister says that there's not one day that can be spared on this. We need to move ahead with it. It seems like there is some kind of a timeline they're following after the ceasefire was announced in order to have this Abraham Accords and the so-called normalization to take place. Do you see it that way?
Well, of course, there is clearly an agenda, of course, to bring on board some of the other Arab nations in West Asia, particularly Syria is one of the targets for that. And there's some discussion going on with the occupying regime in Damascus by the ISIS leader, is that they want to normalize the relationship, and Israel has, the Zionist entity has promised that it would vacate the Golan Heights, and they're talking about that Golan Heights would be a peaceful place. But the reality is that we can see that the nations that joined the Abraham Accord in the past have really become subservient and vassal states to the Zionist regime. So yes, they will move very deeply. But one thing that I like to comment is that, you know, it's a misnomer to call it Abraham Accord, because Prophet Abraham, I'm sure, is very, very unhappy that his name is being led to this diabolical and satanic accord. Whereby Prophet Abraham, if he were alive today, I think he would be breaking the idols that did in the temple at that time. Really, it could be named something else, perhaps the Satanic Accord, rather than Abrahamic Accord. Because, it's very clear it's in the interest of Zionist entity to bring as many Arab nations in West Asia on board. So, the nations can be subservient, as I said, But of course, that also opens a Pandora's box for those regimes, because the public, the ordinary public, does not agree with the leadership in those countries. So there could be a potential sort of ordinary people coming out on the street against these sort of moving forward on the Abraham Accord in different nations. But we'd have to sort of watch this space and see what happens.
All right, very well. I do appreciate your time. Thank you very much for that. Shebe Rizvi, political analyst there, speaking to us from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mikava Tafe and the team, it's goodbye.
You're listening to Hosseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Rezavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alayka Ya Aba Abdullah. Peace and salutations upon you, Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I send my condolences for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam upon you, brothers and sisters, and I welcome you to the program Husseiniyya. The Ashura of Imam Hussein has many lessons for us to learn. Ziyarat Ashura is a ziyarat that is a gift by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam to us. And we learn that the bala of Imam Hussein is not only limited to him, it is also our bala. It is also our trial and tribulations. It is also our misfortune. When we look at Imam Hussein alayhi salam and we see how patient he was, how strong he was, that his patience even amazed the angels. And he was a mountain, and he gave patience to his followers. We learn that in life, we need to be able to deal with our own trials and tribulations. We learn that we need to be strong. And we said that if a person wants to reach happiness, happiness is what? Happiness is minimizing pain. Happiness is managing our misfortunes. Happiness is maximizing our joy, enjoying life, enjoying spirituality, enjoying religion. Therefore, the more we manage bala, the more we understand bala, the better we will enjoy our own life. And this is a great lesson in Ashura, inshallah. One of the methods that we talked about how to manage pain, how to face difficulties, we said we need to be aware that difficulty faces everybody. Two, that we have to have correct action, that we can have resolve, and that we have to have plans, how to take care of our financial needs, how to take care of our emotional needs, how to take care of our family needs, how to live in society in a correct way. There are methods and skills that we learn. We need to learn that sometimes there are trials and tribulations that happen, and that we have to become very strong, and we need to have the strength to overcome them. And one of the ways, and maybe the best answer to how to manage our pains and how to manage such difficulties that all human beings face, is this answer, is that when we accept the fact that we are an abd, that we are a slave of God, that we are His servant, we understand that He is our Lord, that He has commands and He has plans for us, and that we truly understand that when He wants us to be faced with hardship, that there is good in that hardship, that He is a loving Lord, He is a caring Lord. He is trying not to just torture us. He is trying to make us excel. He is trying to have us, our position, be elevated. The commands of God, true, they have maslahat, they have good in them, they separate us from mafsada, from corruption and from bad. True, there's purpose and goal in the commands of God. But the fact that He commands and gives us orders and things to follow, and He gives us trials for us to overcome, this is so that He can make us a greater abd, make us more humble. When we become more humble, we become similar more to the prophets and to the imams. When we become more humble, we get closer to God. And that is the essence of spirituality. Look at Satan, for example. He worshipped God, but he was arrogant. But Balaam makes us humble. Many times, brothers and sisters, you faced difficult times in your lives probably, and your tears have shed and your heart has been broken. Then when you cry and you claim that you love Allah, that you need help from Him, that is when you're the most sincere. That is when you're the most connected to God. Why? Because that is when you have realized ubudiyat. That is when you have become a slave of God. A humble slave that owes nothing, that owns nothing, that is completely faqir, and that realizes he is ghani, that he has all the things that the creation needs and wants. And that's the essence of the trials and tribulations that follow us, that it makes us a greater abd.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry while infant children die, Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein.
Welcome back. We were talking about bala, and we're talking about misfortunes, trials, and difficulties that we face in our lives and how we can overcome them. We said that when a person realizes that there is a purpose to this bala, that is the essence of the solution of how to deal with our calamities. That we know there is purpose and we know there is reward. Imagine if a person lived life and he didn't believe in God. He didn't believe in a wise creator. He didn't believe in a commanding Lord. And that all these different factors from the beginning, you know, when you're a baby, from being hungry and thirsty and being in pain, until when you become an adult and you have your own different trials and tribulations. You see that life is filled with such great pain, but you don't know where that pain is coming from and what is the purpose of it. Imagine how deep in darkness a person would be and how confused they would be and how weak a person would be. But on the other side, we have believers that they believe in Allah and they believe that when God brings for them trials and misfortunes, there is a purpose to it. And that purpose is to bring him closer to himself, to bring us closer to God. Then that person becomes very actually joyful, even in the face of trials and tribulations. He becomes even grateful. He becomes so spiritual that he realizes that everything from God, either if we see it as good or if we see it as bad, all of it is good for us because he is taking us towards himself and is removing us from the nafs, the desires, the ego, the greatest barrier between us and God. He is shattering that. Once that's shattered, we connect to God. We become very easily connected to God. Imam Ali alayhi salam in Sermon 192 in Nahj al-Balagha talks about this. It says, but Allah tries His servants with various ordeals and obligates them with various forms of struggle and tests them with various dreads. So there's struggle, there are dreads, there are ordeals, but there's a purpose why Imam Ali says this. He says there's a purpose. إِخْرَاجًا لِتَكَبُّرْ مِنْ قُلُوبِهِمْ to, in order to eradicate vanity from their hearts, takabur and arrogance, the same attribute of Satan, to take the Satan away from us, to make us humble. وَإِسْكَانًا لِتَذَلُّلْ فِي نُفُوسِهِمْ to take away vanity from their hearts and instill humility in their souls. And that this may open the doors to His favor and the feasible means to His forgiveness. Allah is making us, instilling humility in us. Allah is taking away arrogance from us. And that is what the purpose of our life is, to be an abd. Don't we say in our salat, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluh, that I bear witness that Prophet Muhammad is His slave first and then is His messenger. Being a slave of God is the greatest quality of our Prophet. And that is how we reach Him and connect to Him. Not by arrogance. Not by doing whatever our nafs wants, because our nafs is our greatest enemy. By actually taking away ourselves from the nafs and the lower desires into just submission. As the traditions say, religion Islam is huwa taslim. The religion of Islam is nothing but submission to God. And this submission itself brings us so much power, gives us so much strength, gives us such great favors, that a person that becomes a true slave, a true servant of God, becomes the most powerful person, becomes the most able to manage their pains and difficulties, because they see themselves as a student of Imam Hussein. They see themselves, when trials and tribulations happen, they see themselves as being tested, and they want to pass this test, just how Imam Hussein alayhi salam passed his test and even amazed the angels with his patience. We want to pass this test. So in this Muharram, that we are understanding bala, this great bala that happened on Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we reflect on our own lives, and we say that we want to be able to, just like our Imam, just like our master Imam Hussein, dealt with his pains, we want to become like him. How did he deal with his pain? The solution is he was an abd. He understood that this bala is for a purpose, and that purpose is to increase him more in ubudiyat, in being a slave of God, in being humble in God, and to take away everything else besides God in his heart. Inshallah, in this Muharram, we can learn to become a greater servant of God, a greater slave of God. And this is the key to dealing with trials and tribulations and difficulties in our life. Inshallah.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, the Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad. Thank you.
Azadi Square, the most famous in Tehran, tiny black flags hanging around the tower are not there at ordinary times like this. But now, these small black flags are symbols. They are the signs of one of the most important mourning ceremonies in Iran. I am a filmmaker, and you can only hear my voice. I am the narrator of the documentary. These days, all of us are grieving for the martyrdom of a noble man, Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam. He said once, "If you have no faith, at least be a free man." Our home is near Azadi Square. In Persian, Azadi means freedom. Like many other young people, I write the Imam's name on my car's rear windshield. I'm heading to a city lying 677 kilometers from here. It's one of the most beautiful historical cities in the country, known for holding vigorous ceremonies for the Imam every year. Yazd, a desert city in southeastern Iran, with very humble and warm-hearted people who also speak with a charming Persian accent. It is the city of beautiful, tall wind catchers and the most important mud brick city in the world, the city of winds and wind catchers. Wind catchers are in fact towers acting as ventilators. Yazd has a dry climate with very hot summers, and the wind catchers are built to cool the inside of the houses. This is Dolatabad Garden, home to some of the tallest wind catchers in the city. Since the advent of Islam, Yazd has been known as Darul Ibadah, or the place of worship. Yazd means pure and holy. It is named as the holy city, or the land of God. First of all, I have to find a hotel. I have plenty of time until tomorrow, which is a holiday. Meanwhile, I can start seeing the sights. The hotel staff is shrouding the white columns with black cloth. According to Professor Saper, after the death of Muawiyah, the first caliph of the Umayyad dynasty, his son Yazid became heir to the throne, and he became the Muslims' caliph. Since Yazid was a corrupt and oppressive person, Imam Hussein did not accept to swear allegiance to him. The Grand Mosque of Yazd. From the university, I head to the Grand Mosque of Yazd, one of the most beautiful architectural constructions of the Temurian era. The building is one of the architectural masterpieces of the 9th lunar Hijra century. Scaffolds have now been erected around the mosque in order to refurbish the building. The old janitor says the area spans 10,000 square meters. The mosque is famous for its wide dome, tall entrance, lofty minarets, and its unique and beautiful tiles. When I was filming the old gates of the mosque, I heard some people almost whispering in Spanish. I was surprised. There was an Iranian translator and two female Spanish doctors, Ilma, a lung specialist, and Lola, an ENT specialist. When they start to leave, I hear a charming elegy from a handicraft store. The name of the store is Khurshid Khanum, Miss Sun. Saeed, the shop owner, is watching a mourning ceremony held for Imam Hussein on his computer. He fights back his tears for a while, but very soon, he gives up. Khurshid, the son, is Saeed's grandmother's name. He named his store after his grandmother and carved the emblem of the sun on all its handicrafts. He says the old door locks and the lanterns are his favorites. Although I try hard to convince him to have an interview on Imam Hussein, he refuses to accept, saying he is too shy. But when I turn off the camera, he says, "I hate lying. I love Imam Hussein because he never lied under any circumstances, and he only sought to get the truth out." On his hard disk, he has a lot of religious music from Yazd. I give him my flash drive and he copies some of the songs onto it for me. Then I buy a map of Yazd from him. Saeed shows me the locations of the Tasua and Ashura ceremonies in the city. The postcards from Yazd, photos of all the historical and tourist attractions of the province. Saeed tells me Amir Chakhmak Square is close. So I go there on foot to show you Nakhchir. But what is a Nakhl? There is a lot to say about that. In the same neighborhood, there are other handicraft stores that have really beautiful stuff. I like to stay longer to take a look. We never get tired of looking at and buying Iranian handicrafts. How about you? There is a mosque named Amir Chakhmak, one of the most beautiful in the whole country. It was built in the 9th lunar Hijra century. In 1935, it was registered as a national treasure. Next to the mosque, there is a Nakhl, the oldest wooden one in Yazd. It is 9 meters high and 450 years old. Like all other Nakhls, this one looks like a cedar as the symbol of freedom. It weighs around 4.5 tons and takes at least 150 people to lift it up. The Nakhl is here only for public display and has not been lifted for years because of its old age and the likelihood of damage.
My name is Saeed. I'm half German, half Persian.
He's from Germany and now studies Persian at Dehoda School in Tehran. He's just arrived from Shiraz and takes tens of photos of Amir Chakhmak.
I live in Hamburg in Germany, and today I'm here in Yazd. We're in the month of Muharram, and in the next 2 days we're gonna have the Ashura. The Iranians have like this really, really big and important holiday tomorrow and the day after.
Mr. Azizullah is a former school teacher and principal. He says he's learned from Imam Hussein not to tyrannize anyone. He says because of that, you cannot find a single student or teacher who was mistreated when he was in charge. Being a follower of Imam Hussein is a national school of thought. During Muharram, Iranian Armenians, Christians, Zoroastrians, and all other religious minorities also mourn. This is the Zoroastrian fire temple in Yazd. The city's best confectionaries are the Haji Khalifa stores. The sweets and cookies of Yazd are widely popular in Iran and are the main souvenirs from the city. Baklava with flavors of pistachio, almond and coconut, or qutab cookies are really delicious. I'm a fan of freshly cooked qutabs myself. When you put it in your mouth, it just melts away on your tongue. Baklava and qutab are traditionally served at both celebrations and mourning ceremonies in Yazd. During Ashura and Tasua, you can see a lot of people serving noql, or sugar-coated almonds, among the mourners. The clock in my hotel room strikes 11. I lay on my bed, exhausted. In our official calendar, Tasua and Ashura are public holidays. I begin surfing the net for pictures of the beautiful views in the city. Commenting on Imam Hussein's uprising, a website writes the Imam's movement was not personal. It was a universal human movement. If the goals of a movement are truth and justice, it'll be supported and respected by everyone.
حضرت ابا عبدالله به جایی رسیده بود که دیگه دو دنیا در مقابل عشق خدا، در مقابل دفاع از حقیقت مطلق خدایی ارزشی براش نداشت و این است که با کمال افتخار، با کمال بشاشیت، با کمال قدرت و آگاهی خود و اهل بیتش را قربانی این مکتب کرد.
People hoist flags across the alleys. The flags bear the name of Imam Hussein, the other imams, or sentences in their honor. They are mostly green, black, or red. These are the three colors of Muharram. Red is the symbol of blood, the bloodbath in Karbala. Green represents the nobility of the Prophet Muhammad's family. It's the color of the Prophet and Islam. And black, the color of grief, as it is in most other religions. People are preparing for today's morning ceremony. Young people have written different things on the back windshields of their cars, mostly about the attributes of Imam Hussein and his family. Some of the morning ceremonies are specific to Yazd, such as the Nakhl lifting. But the rest, such as the chest beating ceremony, are conducted all over the country. In Yazd, there are many mourning groups called Hayat, each neighborhood having its own Hayat. The people gather in the mosque or the mourning place of their neighborhood a month before and rehearse the elegies and poems that they want to perform during Tasua and Ashura. When they are prepared, they immediately stay in line for the main performance so that they can perform their ritual at the time set for them. If someone narrates the tragedy, everybody stops to listen. And when he sings the elegy, they accompany him by beating their chests or beating their shoulders with tiny chains in sync with the rhythm. Each hay'at takes its turn entering through the main gate, and after its performance, it exits from another. The ladies usually sit around the hall or upstairs watching the ceremony. They sit in grief in a sign of mourning for their imam.
Thank you. Aquí Teherán, la voz de la República Islámica de Irán.
Estimados oyentes, ahora escucharán las aleyas 9 a 11 de la sura de Hud del Sagrado Corán, recitadas por el señor Vaghefi.
ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات